It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Barrett today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Biden administration held a conference on hunger and nutrition in America, its second ever, and we're going to learn more about the extent of the issues and the proposals that the president has announced. But first, as you may have heard from WPR News this afternoon, the mayor of the city of La Crosse, Mitch Reynolds, is already saying the city may be forced to declare a state of emergency this winter to care for people who are without homes. Homelessness in a city, state of emergency declaration forthcoming evidently from the mayor of La Crosse. But what if you don't have a city to declare a state of emergency? What then? Homelessness in rural America and rural Wisconsin. It's a problem being faced by many residents around Wisconsin, where housing options have also become more and more limited. So I want to invite you into this discussion at 1-800-642-1234. Do you live in a more rural part of our state? And what are housing options like where you live? Do you observe much of a problem with people living with homelessness in your area? And are you someone who's currently experiencing homelessness or home insecurity, or know someone who is or has previously? We'd love you to share your story. It may do some good and hopefully connect you with some resources as well this half hour. Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email's also available to you at any time, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Michael Hall, Associate Director of the organization Foundations for Living that serves people experiencing homelessness in Waupaca County. Michael, welcome to the Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Also joining us this half hour, Brad Paul, Executive Director of Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, otherwise known as WISCAP, a statewide network of organizations fighting poverty. Brad, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you, and thanks for your interest in the story.
Yeah, and let's begin with you, Brad. Introduce us a little bit to WISCAP and the work that you do every day.
Sure. WISCAP is the State Association of Community Action Agencies, and these are anti-poverty organizations born out of the War on Poverty back in the 60s. In Wisconsin, that means 16 community action agencies and two what are called single-purpose agencies. They all work on fighting poverty. They're local, so anyone in your listening area will have a community action agency that services that area. And they all provide direct service ranging from housing assistance, food pantries, job training, literacy, the whole range of anti-poverty programming. We're also, as I said, in addition to being everywhere in the state, that includes, pertinent to this conversation, a lot of rural areas. We have members in Milwaukee and Dane, but most of the member organizations are in geographies that are quite rural, and they see rural poverty from that lens.
And Brad Paul, from what you see, do you have some rough estimates of how many people are experiencing homelessness or home insecurity in Wisconsin's urban, suburban, and rural areas?
Well, this is a tricky question, and it's really at the core of when we talk about rural homelessness. The problem with estimating numbers of homeless in the state or any state, it's a national challenge, is that we have competing definitions of homelessness. So the HUD definition, which is what really drives policy, federal policy, counts those who are in shelters and on the street. That's mostly the extent of what is considered homeless under that definition. By comparison, the Department of Education has a more expansive definition. It includes people who are living in motels, families and children that are doubled, tripled up for lack of an alternative, a more expansive definition that gets at housing insecurity. And for our discussion, that's really where most rural families and homeless individuals fall in that definition. Having said that, when we take those two numbers combined, so when we take the HUD definition, which is arrived at, or the numbers arrived at every couple, twice a year, the state of Wisconsin sends out teams of folks to do a point in time count. That number's up, hovers at around 5,000 per year for the state. That's the point in time count. That's the definition that gets its way, works its way into the media, lands on the desk of policymakers. That's the number. When you take the Department of Public Instruction definition, on the other hand, who have, by school district are counting homeless kids as identified by the school liaisons in those districts. Last year, DPI counted over 17,000 kids throughout the state of Wisconsin who were homeless at some point. So it's a crude estimate, but if you take just those two baseline numbers, you're looking at over 20,000 people in the state of Wisconsin last year who experienced homelessness.
That's Brad Paul, Executive Director of Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, or WISCAP, and invite you to join us at 1-800-642-1234 if you've got an opinion or story to share. Also joining us, Michael Hall, Associate Director for Foundations for Living. And Michael, how would you assess the state of people living with homelessness or some form of home insecurity in Waupaca County?
Yeah, I would echo a lot of what Brad had to say when it comes to trying to find numbers and what are those exact numbers. We look at what we have here come through the shelter last year was 43 individuals. But our school district says flat out that there are 60 kids that are homeless in our community, just in the city of Waupaca and their school district alone. So it's really hard to put your thumb on a number. And I just think based on whatever the criteria might be is what kind of determines where the numbers come from. But I would just, again, what Brad said was pretty spot on. It's a lot bigger than what the numbers show.
So Michael, how does Foundations for Living help those who are looking for your services? Do they find you? Do you find them? How did those connections happen?
Well, we're pretty well known in the community. We do have relationships with the county, with local law enforcement. And so anybody that's looking for those types of services, we're pretty well visible. We're a crisis center, a warming shelter. We have a thrift store. We offer recovery services. Those simple things like just food or clothing or help with a water bill, general hygiene products, those sorts of things. So people know where to go when they are in need.
And Brad, Michael seems to be echoing a lot of what you see. How about his assessment in Waupaca County and how you apply that to the rest of Wisconsin right now?
Well, what Michael describes is similar to both the occurrences of homelessness in a lot of these smaller communities, but also the response. An agency like his provides really critical relief, because what they do is they provide the whole range of services, not just one particular program model. That includes transitional housing, which has really been de-emphasized by HUD over the years. A mistake in my estimation, but important that agencies are still doing that along with those sort of wraparound services. It's similar to what CAP agencies do. We provide, meaning our members provide the whole range, because, you know, as housing advocates, which I consider myself one, we've spent a lot of time over the last 20 years talking about the need for more housing, and that's crucial. That's absolutely fundamental to this story. But we've done less. We've been less successful in pushing for better wages, better income supports, mental health, substance abuse services, counseling. It takes more than just affordable housing, even though that's probably at the center of what we're talking about. And homelessness in rural areas, as I said earlier, really reveals itself differently than it does in an urban area. I mean, you don't have the congregate shelters like you do in a place like Milwaukee or Madison. So you don't see those. You don't see people sleeping on the streets in the same way you do in an urban area. It's the folks, it's the families living in barns, living doubled, tripled up, motels, anywhere they can to keep their kids off the street. That's what you see more commonly in rural areas, and it just doesn't match up with federal policy of the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, and Brad, how do your community action members connect the services for those in need across the state? Do they find you or you find them? How does it work?
Well, like Michael said, our agencies are pretty well known in the community. Most of them have been around since the 60s and 70s. They're well established, trusted resources in those communities. We have some agencies that have sort of three county service areas, others maybe five, six county service areas. Our agency in Milwaukee, the Social Development Commission, is the one CAP agency for that city. So the geographic footprints are different, but the common thread is that all those agencies have been around a while and understand how to address poverty needs in their particular community, because every community is different, obviously.
Michael Hall, why do you think some of the reasons we might overlook as institutions or just individuals, folks who are experiencing homelessness in more rural areas?
Well, like Brad had to say, I've been a volunteer at the warming shelter here before. I was the associate director for about 3 years. And so it's on my radar. And we also do some pastoral ministry in the area. And I've never once seen a person sleeping on a park bench in our community anywhere. I mean, you just don't see it, so you don't know. And that is kind of the biggest thing, is trying to fight something invisible. So you look at people when they come in for other crisis services, and you ask questions, and you try and get to find out from them directly, hey, are you experiencing homelessness? And this is what homelessness looks like. And then that way we're able to meet that need and get them, you know, potentially into, you know, actual housing units in the community or in the shelter if need be. That's kind of the way you have to go about handling it in these rural areas.
And then do schools, especially in rural areas, become one of those contact points as we talk about the numbers of the federal housing and urban development compared to our own state's Department of Public Instruction homelessness?
I mean, I think schools are a touch point, but I don't think that there is a very good continuum of care because typically speaking, that's going to go into the, you know, maybe county social services or perspective, I guess, potentially could be even going to other agencies that aren't connected with our community at all. So it can become difficult to get the information about those students to us so that we can reach out and try and help.
So Housing and Urban Development has over $54 million in funding available targeting rural homelessness, and they are accepting applications now through October 20th. When we continue with our guests, we'll take a look at what that funding could do in Wisconsin to help fight homelessness in rural areas, and we'd love to hear from you as well at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We will continue our conversation with Michael Hall from Foundations for Living in Waupaca County and Brad Paul, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation, taking a look at homelessness in our rural areas across Wisconsin. It exists even if you do not see it, and that's according to the numbers that we have, as well as our guests, Michael Hall, Associate Director of the organization Foundations for Living, serving Waupaca County, and Brad Paul, Executive Director of WISCAP, the Wisconsin Community Action Program Association. We want to hear from you as well this half hour about homelessness, home insecurity at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us ideas@wpr.org. And Brad, I'm going to turn to you here about housing and urban developments now. $54+ million that is set to target rural homelessness and the applications that are now open and available through October 20th. Just going back to the story earlier from the mayor of La Crosse, Mitch Reynolds, who said when talking about homelessness, significant challenges have to be addressed that go well beyond funding. What could this housing and urban development do to address rural homelessness in Wisconsin?
Well, the announcement's welcome. I mean, obviously, that's a significant amount of money, and that will serve a lot of needs. One of the challenges with the money and the ongoing challenge has been there's a really heavy emphasis on that particular announcement as well on the unsheltered homeless, which we obviously need to include in any strategy, and we need to address the needs of all people experiencing homelessness. But as Michael said before the break, that gets tricky in rural areas when you talk about unsheltered. First of all, there's not many shelters, so even counting that is difficult. But the unsheltered don't reveal themselves as much in rural areas for the reasons that Michael talked about. And so with that as the point of emphasis on this new money, I sometimes fear that we're talking about sort of old strategies and new packaging. And so I'm a little concerned that may be the emphasis a bit misplaced, certainly needed nationally and certainly needed in urban areas. But the grant opportunity includes a lot of money for the homeless system, the continuum of care. And it includes what I think is probably most promising. It includes, I don't know, somewhere in the area of about $40 million, if I'm not mistaken, for vouchers. And I think that will go a long way towards helping address some people's housing needs in rural areas.
Would those be housing vouchers?
Yes, correct.
And Brad, what do you see about the potential funding here from Housing and Urban Development as they focus on rural homelessness or rural home insecurity for pretty much the first time in such a scale?
Well, you know, we've been talking about differences, but one thing that's common, whether it's urban or rural, is that we have a national housing crisis. Yeah. And housing prices are up everywhere, rent specifically, and we're talking about individuals and families that really are part of the home ownership market. They're renters. Rent is up. Available units are tight. The vacancy rates statewide are very low, below 5%. So the squeeze is on, really, for people, whether you're in urban or rural areas right now with respect to the housing market. And then on top of that, you've got a really sort of a unique dynamic in a rural area where, you know, if a new company comes to town, that creates opportunity, and yet it makes housing costs spike, right? And so you have that along with the flip side of that. If an industry leaves a rural area, then the wages go with that. You know, maybe some players like a Wisconsin Rapids and its challenges with the paper mills over the years. So the rural piece is tricky because of those dynamics, but the commonality is housing and housing prices and lack of available units. And so HUD making this kind of investment is good. I think they could probably tweak the approach a little bit to more accommodate the realities in rural areas, but certainly the infusion of dollars and vouchers can only help.
Brad Paul, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, otherwise known as WISCAP. Also joining us, Michael Hall, Associate Director for Foundations for Living, which serves Waupaca County. Also want to include you in our conversation at 1-800-642-1234, where we go to Linda in Duluth this afternoon. Linda, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I want to talk about something that I hear left out whenever anybody's talking about homelessness, which I describe as being deprived of housing. I have been without housing several times in the last 20 years. I'm a single person. I don't have family. And I know a lot of other people in the same boat. I have been employed, for example, on a Department of Homeland Security contract, which required me to have a master's degree. There was no apartment available in the city where I was. I had to live in a homeless shelter. And when I was in that homeless shelter for like 7 months, I met many other professional people who were deprived of housing and working. We're full-time employed people, and we can't find housing. You only have to be a single person needing a one-bedroom apartment in many cities, in many states, and rural areas of this country to find out how big this problem is. And one thing that happened over the last 20 years is more and more work became temporary by contract. When contracts end, you're out of employment. You often have to move to a new place, a new state, and good luck finding a place to live, even when you've got a job.
What would you do, Linda? What would be priority number one for you if you were to lead the charge against homelessness?
Build more housing.
The solution to homelessness is housing. Linda, thank you so much for the call. Michael Hall, professionals, and Linda not alone, spending 7 months in a shelter because they couldn't find housing. Is the solution as simple as housing?
Yes and no. I mean, it's certainly we need more housing, but when you're looking at the general clientele that we're dealing with on a pretty regular basis, you have to contend with background checks and credit checks and those sorts of things. And even if it's not really that they have particularly bad credit, but perhaps, you know, when 10 years ago they are facing an eviction and that's on their record, you can have a lot of houses and a lot of empty houses if they can't pass the checks to get in. And that's pretty common an issue across the state, so far as I can tell.
Linda, thank you so much for sharing your story. We turn now to Steve in Chippewa Falls. Steve, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Thank you for taking my call. My first thought is, are we defining ourselves into a homeless problem by saying only so many people can live in a home together and sort of making rules that didn't exist back in the 50s and 60s and 70s when a big family would live in a relatively small house? And I wonder if there's that. And then number two, if you just have vouchers and vouchers, are you putting some people in and driving other people out because you're just driving up the cost of housing by pouring more money onto the inflation fire? And the third thing is, if you've been at this for 60 years and the problem isn't being solved, it's getting worse and worse and worse, Should we maybe take a different tack and turn this sort of, take this away from government agencies and turn it back to maybe ask the churches, ask the local local groups to house local people and take it away from being a government function?
Steve,
those are my questions. I'll listen.
You brought up a litany there, so let's go down the list. And, Brad, I'll turn to you. Are vouchers, the potential of vouchers, only going to create inflation and worsen the housing crisis?
Well, no, I don't know if I would subscribe to that. I mean, we've been retreating from investment in housing for 40 years now. And to sort of turn this over or sort of to close the circle on his questions about government, the challenge that we have is that what we're talking about are the lowest income renters possible, right? And so the market generally doesn't build housing for that sector. And so because of that, it's really up to the government to fill that space. He mentioned the really crucial role that churches and charities play, and I agree with that. But they're not able to create housing on the scale that we're talking about. And so if we're going to fill that gap, which is significant, in the state of Wisconsin, you've got 150,000 households that are paying more than 50% of their income on housing. If you're going to fill that gap, you really need some alternative to the private sector, and historically that's been the government, less so over the last 40 years, and I think we have to reckon with that finally.
So from your perspective, the government's actually pulled back over the last 40 years. Churches, community organizations, they've always been involved and will continue to be.
100%. Valuable partner in it all.
We are out of time, but I want to thank you both. Brad Paul, Executive Director, Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Michael Hall from Foundations for Living, serving people experiencing homelessness and home insecurity in Waupaca County. Thank you so much for your work and sharing it with us as well.
All right. Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
And certainly this topic deserves more discussion, and we will continue. And we invite you to join the conversation at any point by emailing us ideas@WPR.org. Now, coming up after the news, Biden administration released proposals for tackling hunger and nutrition issues in the U.S., and we're going to talk to a pair of food and health experts about the root causes of these problems and how the president's proposals could address them. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, student athletes from the class of 1972 are finally being recognized for their participation in high school sports after graduation, 50 years after graduation, but before Title IX ever became law. It's coming up, but right now, ever gone to bed hungry? How'd you sleep? Ever go to work hungry? How'd you perform? Ever go to school hungry? How'd you learn? President Biden held a conference on hunger, nutrition, and health last week. His administration announced a plan to try and tackle food insecurity and diet-related diseases like obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. The president's proposals include changes to nutrition labels and expanding meals for children both in and out of school.
Because in every country in the world, in every state in this country, no matter what else divides us, if a parent cannot feed a child, there's nothing else that matters to that parent. If you look at your child and you can't feed your child, what the hell else matters?
We're learning more about some of the causes and potential solutions for hunger and nutritional issues in Wisconsin and the United States at large. And we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. See issues with hunger in your community? Maybe you work at a school or in healthcare or a nonprofit organization. What do you see? Share it with us, please. Or what about nutrition problems? Are you dealing with rising rates of obesity or diabetes in your area? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Andrew Reese, is Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, and he's a fellow in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of the book Eating to Learn, Learning to Eat, The Origins of School Lunch in the United States. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutritional Sciences Department at UW-Madison. Beth, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And Beth, I'll begin with you. What did you see from the President's Conference on Nutrition and Food Insecurity last month? Evidently, it's the second ever that we've ever held. What came of it? What did you see?
What I felt was so different about what we've been doing in the past is he really tackled hunger with a much broader lens. So in the past, I think we did a pretty good job of putting together programs that helped feed people that were hungry. But he's looking at it much more broadly about how do we bring families up, which is why I think he talked about some of the economic programs. Now, I'm not as familiar with those, but of course, being able to provide for your family will do a long, go a long ways towards helping people not be hungry. I think he also looked at it across agencies in the government, but also public, private partnerships. He looked at driving it down to the local level where people know what's best for them. And then I think the other really big point he brought out is hunger isn't, you know, distributed uniformly across our population. We have people that are very much at risk. People of color are more likely to be hungry or food insecure. But he also brought up disabled people, elderly people, people with many children that are in school. When schools shut down, they may be extra hungry, but also things like our LGBTQI plus community and rural populations. So I think he really recognized the broad nature of the problem and then the different kinds of people and the different ways it might be affecting them.
And Andrew, I want to ask you about the story from the WPR News this afternoon about the loss of universal free lunch and how some Wisconsin school districts are now seeing some students skipping meals. How big of an issue is hunger in Wisconsin as compared to the rest of the country? And give us some perspective of how we got to this point, please.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a real problem. For the last several years, schools have benefited from a temporary program that allowed them to provide essentially universal free meals to students and even to students' families. And that went away this past summer. And we've seen both in Wisconsin and nationwide a real decline then in ability to participate in that program. There have been a few states that have introduced legislation to guarantee universal free meals. I believe California, Vermont, and Maine up to this point. But other states, it's basically reverted back to the pre-pandemic system where either schools had to qualify through community eligibility or individual students had to qualify for free or reduced price meals. And that's making it harder for many families to participate in one of the key nutrition programs for children in this country.
Andrew, from your position, Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. Is this money well spent? Is this an investment that would see a return on investment? Or is a universal free lunch program giving things away that may not be necessary or could be considered wasteful?
Yeah, so most of the research suggests that it would be highly beneficial. There's research on benefits to children's health. There's research on improvements in future earning potential. There's a host of research on improvements in education. And so, most of the research suggests that a universal free meal program has significant benefits for children in school. But as with many, nutrition initiatives, sort of at the policy level, the debate is often less about whether something like school meals are beneficial, but the question of how much it will cost and whether the cost benefit works out, the way that people want. And so much of the debate about whether we should have a universal free meal program nationwide or even at a given state revolves around, whether the costs justify the benefits.
Andrew Ruiz is Associate Director for Research at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, and Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutritional Sciences Department at UW-Madison. Our guest invites you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Where do you see food insecurity across Wisconsin and beyond the schools? But Beth, I want to ask you about the Universal Free Lunch Program and the story from WPR News this afternoon of students now going without lunch without this universal program. You'd mentioned before that food insecurity isn't across the board, that it's in certain pockets, in certain places, and that we're
that where we're seeing it is, you know, affected differently depending on who you are and where you are. So how can a universal free lunch, or where do we begin to find food security? And we can start with kids, that that can be considered a sound investment going forward for all.
Yeah, I think one of the things that President Biden spoke about and is in their report is looking locally at schools. Can we connect them to local foods so that when kids have school lunch, it's not only local foods, which help local farmers, but it might be more likely to be foods that they're familiar with, that are a part of their culture and a part of their community. I think the other part is removing some of that stigma of getting free lunch so that every child, whether they are having a low income, less income in their family or not, can access that lunch without feeling that there's any stigma or shame. Another thing he talked about, which I thought was really interesting, is let's recruit from our communities into food service. It's being reported that there isn't enough food service employees to cook foods for children. They're getting packaged foods because there isn't enough people to cook. He talked about, and in his report, it's discussed about recruiting and training local people and providing them with quality jobs. So at the same time as cooking good food for our children, we're employing perhaps their parents and other people in their community and allowing them to have the income that they can begin to provide for their families too.
It's interesting to me that not only are we talking about food insecurity, but at the same time, we're talking about obesity. And Andrew, could you square this for us? How is it that there is a connection between food insecurity in this country as well as obesity?
Yeah, so it's obviously a very complicated issue. But, you know, when we're talking about children in schools, you know, as many as 10% of them are in households where there is regular food insecurity, where their parents don't necessarily know where the next meal is coming from or can't guarantee that there will be food available for all meals. And that's not inconsistent with there being large rates of obesity and other diet-related you know, diseases, you know, in the same population. As Beth pointed out, right, these things are not symmetric across populations. And also, it's important to note that, you know, some people are getting enough food if we just look sort of at gross calories or other sort of measures, but they're not necessarily getting the kind of food they needed, as Beth was saying, right? That, you know, many schools are struggling right now, for example, to sort of meet standards for school meals because of labor shortages and because of supply chain issues and a whole host of other things that make planning, you know, healthful and appetizing meals for kids much, much harder. And so all of these issues are kind of entangled in different ways. But, you know, one of the things that's really important about the White House conference is that it's helping to bring national attention, not just political attention, but orient the public towards a lot of these issues, which has the potential, as it did in 1969, to really mobilize support for really expanding and overhauling how we think about nutrition policy in this country.
And Andrew, that 1969, that was our first, and at least until the latest one last week, our first ever conference on food insecurity and diet-related diseases?
It was the first sort of under that title, but it's also important to remember that there were White House conferences on, for example, child health and protection that have significant nutrition components as well. But yes, it was the first that really focused on hunger and nutrition. You know, it really mobilized not only popular support, but political support for a broad range of child and adult nutrition support programs, many of which we still have today. You know, but these are also programs that need to be reauthorized constantly, and that sometimes languishes. You know, there are several bills right now that are part of that that are still sort of working their way through the process in Congress. And so it's also important to remember that these kinds of conferences provide great sort of activation energy for mobilization, but there's sort of a long, difficult road ahead if we actually want to realize a lot of those recommendations.
Andrew Wiss is the Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. Also joining us, Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutritional Sciences Department at UW-Madison. Invite you to join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. Do you bristle at the thought of universal free lunches? Do you not see them as an investment? Or do you understand or have perhaps benefited from them in the past? Have you experienced hunger yourself? What was it like? And how do you overcome it? 1-800-642-1234. Could the solution be as simple as food? You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation next on Central Time. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our conversation on nutrition and hunger after President Biden held a conference on the issues last week. And our guests are nutritional science professor Beth Olson and education researcher Andrew Ruiz from UW-Madison. We'd like to invite you as well to join us at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about the Biden administration's proposals to improve nutrition and address food insecurity? Do you support expanding meal programs at schools? You want to see wider eligibility for food stamps or the WIC program in Wisconsin? What other solutions do you have? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Gary in Hartford this afternoon. Gary, you're on Central Time.
Hello. Yeah, I'm wondering about the school lunches where there's so much waste in the schools and we have meals that are one size fits all. We've got meals that go to one small child that's also supposed to feed one of our older adult child, and yet there doesn't seem to be an even distribution of calories across the board.
Ah, the same caloric intake for a kindergartner and a sixth grader, and then the amount of waste that we find from our food programs. Where would you like to begin, Beth Olson?
Yeah, I think looking at using local foods and also looking at cultural preferences, as well as, I think, you know, just some really good old-fashioned home cooking versus some of the packaged foods that people are needing to use right now because of shortages would go a long way towards waste. I think in demonstration projects where there's more involvement of the children in the recipes, where there's more cooking, where the children get more nutrition education, making use of things like community gardens really increases the amount of food that children eat and really decreases waste.
Andrew Ruiz, what do you see there when it comes to school lunches, the amount of food waste we have, maybe beyond the cafeteria, but just in our own kitchens, and the one-size-fits-all approach for school lunch programs?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Beth on that. The research is very, very clear that the more that a school lunch program, you know, incorporates students into not just, the food line, but into the preparation, into the planning, the more the programs are integrated with education, and the more they are based on a kind of scratch cooking model that can be much more sensitive to local populations, there tends to be quite a lot less food waste and a lot more participation, both of which are significant benefits. And this is, this is true in many cases in home kitchens as well, that getting kids interested in foods and food preparation early is a great way to get them to try new foods. It's a great way to get them to cultivate a taste for a broader range of foods. It's a great way to have conversations with kids about, where the food comes from and issues like food waste and preparation.
And Andrew, a follow-up here. It seemed from the conference last week that the Biden administration is leading into the idea of food as medicine. How do you see that concept?
Yeah, so the recommendation that the government can support things like nutrition prescriptions and support for meals that are sort of medically designed to help people with different health conditions was fairly prominent in the White House conference. Historically, it's a very old idea. Food as medicine has been practiced for thousands of years across pretty much all cultures that we know anything about. It continues to be a sort of focus of of, you know, many, for many advocates, especially nutrition advocates, you know, one of the biggest challenges is that medical training still involves very little training on nutrition and on sort of the ways in which health professionals can support patients in, you know, particular dietary changes or adjustments that they may need to make for their health. And so that's a really big area of opportunity.
And Beth Olson, also from last week's conference, the Biden administration announced a proposal to move nutrition labels from the back to the front of food packaging. What good would that do?
The proposal is about a front of package label, and there are many of those already going on. So we have our side panel, which has the nutrition facts, the nutrition in the food, and the ingredient listing. I personally think one of our efforts should be to help people read those two places of information. They're very regulated, they're very accurate, and I think provide most of the information that people need. It is a lot of information, which is why I think people are interested in having some symbols on the front. Right now, there's a lot of information elsewhere on the label. Some of it regulated, some of it not. Some of it's just advertising. And so it can mislead people into thinking they're picking up a healthier product than they are. So I'm in support of it, but I think that it's just one more tool, and I don't think necessarily is going to be the answer to everything.
We had talked earlier about the president's conference last week on nutrition, food insecurity, and food health, and how it was, you know, get attention, but after that comes the important part of legislation and furthering something through. And some of the president's proposals face some political hurdles. The conference last week was called partisan by some Republicans. In fact, Senator Mike Braun, the Republican from Indiana, who sponsored the legislation to fund the conference, while he appeared at an initial hearing, did not appear at the rest. There was some tepid response from the other side of the aisle last week. So is there a Andrew, do you see politically feasible anything that could get through Washington, D.C. that could help people in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's one of the biggest challenges, I think, of the proposed slate of policies is that the sort of highest impact ones are all ones that are going to need to get approved by Congress, you know, making permanent the child tax credit, universal free school meals, you know, expanding eligibility for SNAP, some of the diet prescription coverage we were just talking about, and so on and so forth. And this is not a Congress right now that seems well positioned to pass any of those at this point. So I think, you know, one of the things that we want to look for coming out of a conference like this is to see how well it mobilizes existing groups. There's a lot of groups on the ground who are already, you know, and have been for a long time working for these kinds of goals. Can this conference mobilize them to really help push these things through, a Congress that may or may not be that willing to support them? And so I think that's going to be, the thing to really pay attention to in the coming year is how well this, this provides the activation energy for that kind of effort.
Beth Olson, do you understand some of the arguments against these proposals for food security and nutritional health? Could this be considered wasteful? Is there opportunity that could be left on the table here? Or is this just good old-fashioned partisanship as you see it?
I think something that people, perhaps the public doesn't understand, and as Andrew mentioned, you know, having this publicity for the conference and our groups out on the ground working, perhaps we can also talk more to the public who elect our officials about what having good health, nutrition, health, physical activity means for the entire population. I've never heard a politician say that they would rather have an unhealthy workforce and a less productive workforce and a military that's, you know, not well nourished or healthy. So I think when we start to talk about the things that make, you know, the United States strong and the people within it strong, we're talking about a healthy children growing to be healthy and productive adults who work and pay taxes and take care of their families. And that's that these kind of programs support that. So I think when people begin to understand it's in all of our best interest that every one of us be as healthy and productive as we can, perhaps we can start to influence our politicians to see it the same way.
And Beth, what are some other brief potential solutions out there that could help address hunger and or nutrition in Wisconsin?
I think there's a lot of potential to the school, to local foods, to school initiatives, also to local school, to places like food banks. I think it helps both the farmers and it helps the people receiving the food. I also feel I need to promote Extension. I work with them and they just have wonderful programs, and they are based in the community. So they recruit people to work for them that are from the community, understand local issues, they know where the people in their community go to school and work and where they go to church and what their stores are like and their parks are like.
We are out of time, but I appreciate the mention of the Extension this afternoon. Beth Olson, thank you so much for joining us. Andrew Ruiz, thank you as well to you.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Ruiz, Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, and Beth Olson is Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutrition Sciences Department at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at the Biden administration's proposals to tackle hunger and nutrition issues in the United States. A huge thank you to everyone who participated in our fall member drive. Just wrapped up on Saturday, over 9 days. There were 5 special incentives, 1 huge participation challenge that lasted over 2 days, and more than 2,000 of you made a gift to WPR. And I was one of them, as so many that I work with was, because we get to see the results every day. And so the drive's over with, but I wanted to take a moment to thank you, each and every one of you personally, for participating. And if you missed the drive, there's still time to join in with your gift anytime at WPR.org. And when you do, you can ask for the tote or you can ask for the socks. But really, the important part here is to thank you for being a part with us. It's what we do every day, and we get up ready to do it, even on a Monday. So thank you for keeping us going, keeping us ready to do it again tomorrow. But we still got more to come today, so stay tuned. I'm Lee Raven, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.